I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and this is Radio versus the Martians.
Red Sonia's Chosen Male asks us.
Oh, yeah.
Wolverine's Bone Claws, cop out or clever retcon? Do you know this one, Sam?
No.
That in the comics for a long time, Wolverine, of course, had the metal claws. And the idea was that that was the same time that he got his adamantium skeleton, he got these claws. And that was just part of that government Canadian death experiment they put him in to turn him into a weapon.
Canadian Death Experiment would be a great band name.
I bet it's taken. But I think that's probably what Ted Cruz calls their healthcare. And that would be a lie. But I love you, Canada. I wish I had your healthcare.
Yeah.
So, basically, in the 90s, there was a storyline where Magneto ripped out the metal skeleton out of Wolverine, and he found out afterwards he'd had bone claws underneath those all along. So he was bone claw Wolverine for a while. So the question is that it kind of a clever retcon so that, you know, Wolverine can still have claws? And I guess he just had metal on top of him this whole time?
I have no opinion.
I don't think I can meaningfully speak about this, yeah.
I don't mind it. I don't really care. It's, I guess, the real question is, I don't know. I don't think it really matters. I don't mind it either way. This isn't.
I'm guessing they abandoned it a long time ago, and he's had real claws ever since.
Well, he's done both. He got his skeleton back, and now they're just covered again. They were in the movies. He had
that's
the
a thing that happens.
Yeah, he had the bone claws, and they're just metal on top of him. It's like getting a crown. So
well, the second question is probably yes. The second question is more apropos for our guest here, which is HBO's Watchmen remix. Looking forward to it, or what the fuck? We made Sam. I mean, this will be the wound, the festering wound.
Yeah.
Is that we made Sam watch the? We didn't make him watch the director's cut, which is the extra long version.
It was the only version I could get. Was the director's
but we
cut
made
version.
Him watch the Watchmen after you probably read the comic book and loved it.
Yeah.
And then you watch the movie and then it's felt down on it.
Just as a bit of an addendum, this is not a sequel to the movie.
Right.
This is a TV show made by Damon Lindelof, who was one of the co-creators of Lost, but also has a lot of goodwill right now because of doing a three-season show called The Leftovers, which I haven't seen, but I've heard is amazing.
Okay. It's going to take a lot to make up Lost for me. I know a lot of people liked it, but it was a show that did kind of torture me back in the day. I don't know. I mean, it would be nice to see a well done live action version of The Watchmen. It really would.
And apparently it's not going to be an adaptation of the comic.
No.
Though I think it takes place in the same world.
No, they didn't want to just retread the same story and make it longer. They didn't want to do the Dune sci-fi miniseries, which is like, oh, well, we have more time so we can just pull more stuff out of the source material. They wanted to remix it, essentially have characters, but a scenario that's similar, but not the same exact plot.
I can imagine Alan Moore is ecstatic.
Oh, I think Alan Moore just doesn't care.
Okay, fair.
He checked out a while ago. The thing that I love most about Alan Moore is that he is not a hypocrite, that he said a long time ago, don't tell me if you're making a movie, don't even send me a check, I don't want to know, just give whatever money you were going to give me to the person who drew it, I don't want a phone call about this. If you're going to do it, I'd rather not know. And so I don't think he knows, though I guarantee somebody told him anyways, and he just said, please don't.
Right. I'm going to do what I did for The Preacher. I'm going to try very hard to hold no opinion, and I will watch the first few episodes, and I'll decide then.
Is the little thing that will spice up the, because I know I care about it. Mike doesn't care.
I care about it being bad that it makes people not read the book, but I can check out.
Yeah. I was thinking one particular development is that Nine Inch Nails is doing the score for this show.
Okay, that changes things a little bit.
Which is sort of mind-blowing when you're like,
although I do have the soundtrack to The Social Network and I've never seen the movie. So that's a thing that I can do.
Yeah,
this is true. Jeremy Irons is going to be playing Ozymandias.
Well, that also helps.
Tim Blake Nelson is in it, but I don't know who he's playing.
Yeah, it's not going to be a direct adaptation. I do have no idea what they're doing. I'd say cautiously optimistic because of the goodwill of Leftovers.
Yeah.
I've not seen it yet, but I have never heard anyone say that Leftovers was garbage. And, you know, I don't know.
The only bad thing I've heard about Leftovers is that it doesn't kick in until the second season. It still is difficult when you're going to be like, well, I got to get through 8 hours before it really catches on. You're like, that's still a big commitment.
But I think for television adaptations, unless you're talking about, like, you're going to do Hyperion or Foundation or something like that, in which case I'm just going to utterly hate you. is like, specifically for Preacher, I was like, they're doing Preacher, you're gonna love it, Sam, and I'm like, I tried to achieve this zen state of uncaring about it, and as a result, the Preacher, the TV show, not very much like the comic book at all, and it's certainly not what I would have wanted to see from a television adaptation. But going into it trying to have as little preconception and as little care for it as possible, I like it. It's good.
My general attitude is basically the same.
Yeah.
That I have gotten old enough that I am not going to be wounded by this being bad. 20-year-old me would have gone on a fucking warpath.
Right.
And
watch out, CBR forums.
Yeah.
Watch out, thing that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Not in any meaningful sense. What is it they said in The Matrix? There are levels of existence they're willing to accept over at CBR. But, you know, there would have been a time that I just demand, like, absolute fidelity to source material, and now I'm just like, yeah, fuck it. I think Watchmen now,
do you want that though? I mean, I think that the Robert Rodriguez Sin City movie was like that, the total fidelity to the source material. But do you want that though?
Not necessarily. I want fidelity to the spirit. Or if something is awful, I want it to shit on the spirit. So it's not like there's a single answer. Again, we're talking about Starship Troopers. Starship Troopers takes a giant poop, a spectacular, awesome poop, all over that book.
Gold-plated poop.
It's amazing. And, and I've seen people make this argument before on the internet, and I agree with it. I forget who said it. It was somebody on YouTube. But they made the argument that Ready Player One should have gotten the Starship Troopers treatment. That there's a lot to say there about, you know, nostalgia and the fact that we just drown ourselves in the stuff that we loved when we were nine. There's something to say there, and there's something biting to say there, and there's something funny to say there. But the movie just wants to go, whoa, it's awesome. And
yeah, I don't think Spielberg was the kind of guy who's equipped to be able to do that.
You don't hand it to the guy who's being massaged, shall we say, in the source material.
You don't jerk off to yourself in the mirror.
Yeah, don't go full Mars Hill.
Yeah, don't go exactly. Exactly. Ooh. But
that is a deep cut.
Yeah.
That is.
But it's nuts because, you know, there's so much of just culture that's self-congratulatory that I really think you kind of need to do something that has the Ninja Turtles in it that's made by someone who kind of hates the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
And understands why they're popular, but says, you know, I got something to say about that. And that's what made the Starship Troopers movie great, because he's just like, you know, this is kind of celebrating fascism. You know what I hate? Fucking fascism.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a movie that just jabs you in the ribs over and over again with this until you fucking get it, and if you don't, I'm gonna make fun of you in the movie.
Yeah. I you know, as far as convert, you know, what do you call it, ports. When you port something,
ports.
Yeah, okay,
you're porting it to VHS.
When you port it to VHS, it helps in my case in that all the things that I'm a big fan of, the bad port had already happened when I discovered it. Like, Dune. I found Dune, like, 10 years after the movie had been made. You know, and I found, you know, I got into the Foundation novels after the really horrible radio plays had been done.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. And so, You know, it helped me avoid having expectations for these things. Not that Dune is a bad movie.
It's just not Dune.
It's just not Dune.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think sometimes you got to get to the point where you're okay with that.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I'm far more offended by the Watchmen adaptation in the sense that it's clearly made by a person who loves the source material but doesn't understand it.
Right.
And I think that betraying the source material is okay when you clearly understand it and you want to zing it. If somebody zinged it, like I think Watchmen today, if you made it into a movie, you wouldn't. The way Watchmen the comic is structured and written and the timeline for it, it's built around the history of comic book superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a group of superheroes that came to prominence in the 40s. There's a group that came to prominence in the 60s. And we're just going to play out in that timeline. And that in the 80s, when it was written, was the present.
And with that particular director, whose name escapes me.
Zack Snyder.
For Zack Snyder, he's a wound I keep picking at.
Yeah, he's because a wound that keeps coming back.
Partially because he keeps coming back, but also because I may not like what he's doing, but I kind of want him to... I want the joy he clearly has for these things to eventually succeed in letting him like reach his goals.
I want him to finally find his strengths, because yeah. I think he plays against his strengths.
Yeah.
If you were going to make the Watchmen movie today, you'd probably have to change the timeline completely so that it feels modern, and it wouldn't be... a satire and a deconstruction of comic book superheroes. It would have to be a deconstruction of superhero movies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That say the same thing. What can you say about these movies that that people are familiar with? Because that's what you're satirizing. Because Watchmen is satirizing a lot of the stuff from actual comic books that are coming out, and people are sort of not really quite getting it because they're used to seeing a one-step removed adaptation of those characters. So... And then this one is being removed by adaptation to the point that it almost, you don't really know what it's doing.
Because
it's like a game of telephone.
And we've got the movie that is the deconstruction of the comic book movie now, which was the last comic book movie I was bolted to a chair and forced to watch, which was Deadpool.
Deadpool, yeah.
And, I know Deadpool is now a cash cow, mm-hmm. but they certainly weren't thinking that way about Deadpool while they were making the first one.
Deadpool is a movie they had to fight to get made.
Right.
But, I mean, Deadpool's a great example of it having fun with those tropes and making fun of the world that it lives in while also living in that world.
Right.
And I think you can do it. I think that, in a lot of ways, the only thing I can say about Watchmen the movie is that it got people to read the comic who would have not otherwise tried it. And for that, I call it a success.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't stop people now that it's out from checking it out.
Well, okay. Jeremy Irons playing Ozymandias, Nine Inch Nails doing the soundtrack. I will look forward to those components while maintaining a strict, almost Switzerlandian neutrality pact with the entire concept.
I think you have to.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll go, I have the movie pass thing from AMC, so I can go to see things for free now. I saw the Venom movie, and that's a good movie to go into with bottom expectations.
That movie evaporated. I assumed it was bad, but nobody ever said.
It's worse than bad. It's mediocre.
Okay.
Because it could, there's something you could do with it. One, it's kind of weird because he's attached to Spider-Man in a way that he can't be in the movie without bringing up Spider-Man. You're like, okay, so how well would this character work divorcing him from the thing that he looks like?
Right.
So you can't put the spider thing on his chest. And he's just kind of a monster from space that attaches himself to a reporter and he eats people, which is a weird thing to turn into a good guy unless... You just go hard rated R and just go, I'm going to do a trauma style cannibal superhero. And you just fucking own it. Because he eats people. This is not somebody who's like, this is my quest, this is my curse. Hey, that guy looks tasty. it's so strange to go there and try to make a PG-13 movie about a guy who eats his enemies. And it feels like if we're going to just go
there. Wait, it was PG-13?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Of course it is. They want to make their money from the kiddies to watch their cannibal movie. But
the stranger thing to me is that apparently some of the better parts I've read the better parts of the movie are when Eddie Brock character has a dialogue with the symbiote because they're two voices, they're not a single voice.
Mm-hmm.
Played by Tom Hardy, of course, and Tom Hardy a couple years ago had an amazing movie called Locke, where the entire movie took place with a guy driving in a car trying to get to the hospital, talking on a cell phone. And you'd be surprised how a movie that is just in one place with one actor and then maybe some people on the, voices on the phone, how much can be done with just that. Tom Hardy is just that good. So the fact that you could have taken a guy who can make a whole movie out of a performance inside a car, behind the wheel of a car, and not make it amazing.
Oh, he's super
Tom Hardy, I'm sorry, my actor database is broken.
He played Shinzon.
We're talking about Shinzon. Okay.
Talking about Shinzon.
Yeah. Mad Max and Fury Road, he played Bane.
Yeah.
The Brain. Yes. That version of Bane.
you went to the rap video, didn't you?
Yes. And what I kind of love about him is that you always get a weird vocal choice from Tom Hardy, no matter the role. It's like, okay, is he British? Oh, he kind of sounds like he's from New York in this. Let's see where he's going. He's kind of got a raspy voice. Okay. And you never really know what you're going to get with Tom Hardy, and I kind of love that he likes to mess around and experiment. Venom, more than anything else, feels like a time capsule movie from 2004, like that era of Marvel movies. You know, where it's almost like, okay, every superhero movie is sort of compartmentalized in its own little continuity, and it just kind of creates its own little world, and I'm like, this feels like a movie that's 15 years old, just with better special effects.
Okay.
And
or
that was,
should be competing with X-Men 3. Yeah.
It does. It feels like a movie that's from that era. And I kind of want it just like, you know, okay, take this concept, give this to Peter Jackson or Sam Raimi and say, why don't you go old school with this? Yeah. And I think that would be a lot more fun and go in more of a fucked up Deadpool direction, because there's so much standard superhero-y stuff that there's definitely a place to go that has a different tone, but is also not taking itself super seriously about a guy who eats criminals. And he like bites people's heads off in this movie. It's fucking weird. And it's always off camera. And it's like, he just ate that person in front of the person at the convenience store that he just rescued. It doesn't really matter what it's like. I appreciate you, you know, but I'm still calling the cops because I have to do something about this body without a head that's in my bodega. It's like, this, and it's like, it's on camera and a monster ate somebody.
I think Headless Body in Bodega is the lead track on the album from Canadian
Death System or something.
Canadian Death System.
Death Test. I think it's what it was.
Oh God. It's just, it's fucking weird. But yeah, it's a movie that just feels so not memorable, with little bits in it that almost work. That again, it's what we did talking about Terminator Genesis. It's a movie where you just kind of want to break it down to its composite parts and recreate it better.
Yeah,
there was a movie that came out a few years ago. I don't know if it's good or not. Called Upgrade.
Oh yeah. It came out this year.
I saw the trailer for that. How is that?
I haven't seen it.
It is a spectacularly great example of a low budget but high concept sci-fi action movie that is done, that the parts of it that are supposed to be sort of audience pleasing and satisfying are great, and the plot is sort of this serviceable standard kind of plot that you expect from a horror movie. Basically, it works really well. Like it's incredibly engaging for the time that you're there.
Okay,
you're not thinking about it very much, but it works.
So the thing that I kind of got from Venom is it felt like the trailer that I saw for Upgrade, which is it's basically about a guy who in Upgrade, I guess it sounds like he gets like an AI nanobot thing injected into him, and he works with it, but can also take over his body, and there's a bit of a push and pull. That's kind of almost exactly what they created with Venom, and it seems, minus the Spider-Man connection, that this is kind of a Dread the Raid sort of situation happening. Where it feels
the
like
twinned movies.
Where I've got a voice in my head that can also take over my body and fight people for me, and I don't really know if it's a good guy or not, but I can kick ass with it. That's the sort of vibe that I got, and I think there's some mileage you can get out of that you're basically have a bacterial infection that helps you fight crime. I mean, that's pretty cool. You can do something
with
that.
Can we just remove this technology aspect of it and just have a bacterial infection that helps you fight crime?
Why not?
That's a pretty good premise. I like that.
But the thing with Venom 2 is...
Starring Brad Dourif, obviously.
That 75% of the time, there's a reason why Venom is a bad guy, and it's a whole, you know, that little problem we get into because he eats people. You know, that's a thing that either you just steer into it and just have him be a crazy ass bad.
Actually, the way you're talking about Venom and its ability and its desire to remain PG-13, but have it be about a guy who, you know, an anti-hero who eats people.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody remember the sci-fi TV show Lex?
Yes.
I have not seen this.
Where it tried to be ribald and weird and strange and gross, but because it was on television, it was because on the sci-fi network, they could be none of those things.
Right.
So it just sort of felt disjointed and stupid and very much of its era. I don't know. For some reason, you talking about Venom reminded me of Lex.
Yeah, it's just like you feel the limitations on it more than you feel the thing it's trying to be.
Right.
Because I know that I exist in a world where people are crossing this line and you're trying to get the credit for crossing that line.
But you're not actually doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Venom really should have just crossed that line and had some serious Paul Verhoeven-style violence in it.
Yeah.
Go for, you know, a really good example, the tone that Venom probably should have gone for. Have you guys seen the Ash versus Evil Dead TV show?
I have not.
No.
It's actually pretty great. The thing that I love that it does is that it actually amplifies things that most reboot late sequel things are not these days, which is it steers hard into the fact that the main character is like 30 years older. And makes him repulsive. Not only is he 30 years older and has some gray hair, but he also wears a girdle and false teeth. And
I strongly identify with this character.
That they do everything they can to make Ash as pathetic and repulsive in every aspect of his life, except for fighting demons. That he's a guy who's amazing at one thing, and that he's a gross weirdo who works at a discount store and the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And what I kind of love about that is that it is hyper-violent and fucked up and funny, and it owns its absurdity in how violent it is. And that's the kind of vibe that I think that Venom should have gone for.
It could have just leaned straight into being a horror movie, which would him being the monster, but the monster being the...
And like a splatter comedy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Just make it as gory and ridiculous as possible and let people have those laugh moments. Like there's a bit in Ash versus Evil Dead where him and one of his coworkers at the store have to fight some demons and he's got a chainsaw and he's like, here, take this bottle, and the guy breaks it and it's just the little bit of the lip part and a little bit that pokes up. He's like, yeah, it looks pretty sharp, you could use that. And it's just, it's like fucked up. It's really kind of fucked up and weird, and it's
wrapping up, isn't it, or has it?
It completely wrapped up. They did 3 seasons. Bruce Campbell said goodbye to the character. But it was a great way to do it because it sort of also had fun with how unwoke the character was and how deeply uncomfortable this guy who's is the greatest time of his life was in the 1980s and now is like occasionally uncomfortably racist. And they're like, yeah, there's a bit in the show where there's an evil double of Ash and they're both arguing about whether it's 2 young sidekick characters, which one they're going to shoot. And they shoot the one who makes the most racist comment. And they're like, you know, well, you're racist, but you're not that racist. And then he makes a casual comment that's kind of racist. They both kind of give each other a look. Like, did we get the right one? And it's little things like that where he's just a bonehead. And I kind of love that sort of aspect of it, is let it be uncomfortable, let it laugh at the main character, let it create an absurdity with the level of violence that it has. And I think that you hit this wall, the Lex wall, I guess we could call it, where you want credit for doing a thing that you're not actually doing, because you can't give up the fact that a 17-year-old is the line where you can let somebody buy a ticket to this movie. But I don't know. Is it weird that we used to live in a time where we all saw R-rated movies way too early?
Yeah.
So,
and now I think that's listed in the Geneva Conventions as a war crime.
Yeah. I don't know when this sort of happened, but I get this sort of impression that, one, I think more people are going to movies by themselves rather than with their parents. But I think parents have gotten a lot more sensitive to the way things in the world affect their kids.
Being the only parent on the panel right now, yeah, I'd say so. I'd certainly say so.
I thought it was a function of my change in location.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've moved from Chicago, which is kind of liberal, but it's a very strange liberal. It's not,
yeah,
it's not like it is in the rest of the country. I had to relearn that unions are good things. And then I moved to Arizona, which was ridiculously, or at least at the time, was a very conservative in both culture and politics state. And then it's here where there is sort of this hyper awareness of risk as just sort of a cultural touchstone.
Yeah.
And so I thought this fear of letting children see violence was a function of where I had moved to. But
I can say it's also a generational thing.
It may also be a generational thing.
Because I definitely can't speak to living in Chicago or Arizona, but I can say, having lived here all my life, that people who are parents that are my age are very different than the parents that I saw people have when I was a kid.
Right.
The stuff that people were allowed to watch at sleepovers, R-rated movies, like most of the things like Alien and Terminator and all those, I saw for the first time at a sleepover.
This is a little bit of a class thing there, in that my mom was a waitress, my dad was a superintendent and a bar musician, and that was sort of the social strata I existed in as I grew up. And we all saw R-rated movies, and now I hang out with computer programmers and oceanographers and meteorologists and stuff like that, and
volcanologists,
yes. Yeah, and it's like this is a different group of people, yeah. And they treat their kids very differently.
But I mean, even in my circles and stuff, I think we're all poorer than our parents. But I think that there's this real sense that people who had a childhood like us were allowed to do this stuff. We're much like, oh, do I really want a kid to see that? And we're much more sensitive. Are we? In a sense, and I can ask you this, Casey, is there anything that you remember experiencing or being allowed to do as a kid that terrifies you in retrospect now that you have kids?
Not really. I'll just say that I'll respond to what you're talking about before and then answer your question. The only censorship really that I witnessed when I was a kid was usually as a result of people that were just in conservative Christian families. And so that's the type of censorship that you would imagine that most people probably experience, is this is just not wholesome or whatever. And so that's why you don't end up seeing it. As far as stuff that I might have seen or witnessed, and the question is that I would be repulsed by now if it were the situation were with my kids. No, I don't think so. I think my wife's tolerance for things that might be objectionable or scary or whatever is far lower than mine is. Like, I think Elliot and I, this is a few years ago, like when he was probably in his late threes, we watched the first hour and a half of the first Lord of the Rings movies. And there's some pretty scary shit.
Yeah.
Like the Uruk-hai being born.
Oh, God.
I was like, that's terrifying. It's so scary. And he was not fazed by it. Of course, my wife wasn't there at all. She wasn't. I think his tolerance for creepy stuff is sort of like mine, which is that he's got a pretty high tolerance, but since something will sneak through the radar screen sometimes, like before Halloween, it was skeletons. And I was like, and that's probably because every single block has people have a fucking gravestone and fake skeletons coming out of their lawn. So he's just seeing it, but none of like the, you know, people getting blown away in the Avengers movies or something is like, has somehow like crept up to the surface. So I don't know.
If I can offer a conceptual counterpoint, I had a very, you know, the free form nature of my media consumption as a child, it wasn't limited merely to media consumption. I was nearly a feral child growing up. I mean, my dad, you know, I wanted to just have a chemistry set, and he let me buy anything. Muriatic acid, no problem, not an issue. You know, take apart the television with, what, 18 kilovolts in the back? Not a problem. Go right ahead.
I'm just imagining the thing with Breaking Bad where the tub falls through the ceiling.
I had my moments like that, yeah. Except he had one rule that I didn't even recognize it was a rule, because it wasn't a thing that I noticed until I started interacting with other kids in the neighborhood, which was no guns. Mm-hmm. No toy guns, no pop guns, no cap guns, no little suction cup guns. He did not want me playing with guns as a kid. And then when all the people in my neighborhood started wanting to play army men, I was forced to use a plastic knife because I didn't have a toy gun.
Oh, you're like Rambo.
Yeah, yeah.
I got to get up close.
I did. And that's, yeah, okay, yeah, kind of flashing back to that now. But and now here we are in 2000, you know, in 2018, and who's the guy who can recognize guns in movies? Mm-hmm. It's me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like my that not being a part of my life later on when I was forced to be introduced to it through
at gunpoint?
I don't know if I'm
you said forced, so I just figured that you were
economically forced.
Okay.
Part of the reason why I know firearms is, and we never talk about this in the show, is because I just never want to ask an atheist, because I never want to fucking get into it. But when I worked in Arizona, the company I worked at, which was a telecommunications company, and we were like our own little section, and the boss was very particular, and it was one of those companies where you were expected to socialize with the boss and suck up to the boss and stuff like that. And in that model, in that sort of American Psycho model, you're either going to clubs together or something like that, or going golfing together. In his case, you had to go to the range.
Hmm.
And so I got there and I'm like, hey, do you shoot? I'm like, nope. Well, you're gonna. And like the guy, my direct report made sure I could own and operate a firearm that would be pleasing to my boss so that I could go to the range. I ended up getting laid off anyway because.
And now you're armed.
Yeah.
It's like because you were a terrible shot.
Yeah.
That's why he felt okay firing you.
Yeah. But it was like a crash course in gun culture. And because it was never a part of my life before. Mm-hmm. And then I go from Chicago, which is not a gun area at all, to Arizona, where I go to the bank and there's a guy with a revolver just cashing a check. So I suddenly got this crash course, and there was a fascination there.
Hmm.
And as a result, I know a lot about, I know more about guns than I probably should. And I have a horrible fascination with them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't see them very often. I think guns to me are like smoking,
mm-hmm.
where it's a thing that I think I was much more aware of it being around when I was a kid. And I haven't seen it for a while, so when it does show up, its appearance, even in a slight and unobtrusive way, is kind of jarring.
Right.
Where I'm like, oh, hey, I didn't see you there at first. I went to a movie theater. AMC has security guards now, and they're packing.
Is that a post the shooting, the Batman shooting, the rise, was it the Rise of the Batman?
Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah.
I think it had to be.
Are AMC hiring their security guards in much the same way they hire pretty much everybody else? Are they basically taking high schoolers and go, here's a gun, go?
I hope not.
Yeah, seriously hope not.
Yeah.
I hope not.
This makes me uncomfortable.
It's weird to see a security guard with a gun, period.
I thought you were going to say that you were sitting next to someone who had like an ankle holster in a movie theater, and you were like, should I be in here? Gun and sitting next to this guy.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, so you're sitting next to Ted Nugent. When,
you live in Kent, though, so, I mean, I live in Seattle, in what you'd consider the city limits of Seattle. You live in Kent.
Yeah, South King County, yeah.
You live in Tacoma. Yep. Like, Tacoma's close to the military base, so I assume that you probably see more people out and about that have holsters and whatnot.
You have to get to, like, Lakewood. You have to go south, basically south of 512 before that becomes common.
So,
it is not common in Tacoma.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Tacoma is kind of a nice microcosm for the entire state, because I think it has a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some rural areas. It's got some urban areas.
Some piss dungeons.
It does have some piss dungeons.
Piss dungeons.
That are my new album, Piss Dungeons.
It's got some Dutch style windmills.
Yeah.
Some piss dungeons.
Piss dungeons for me a little bit.
It's got some shale mines. It's got everything.
But
it's got a dry dock.
I think Tacoma probably is a good way to gauge the entire state. You can kind of get a little bit of everything. You might, you know, you'll see hipsters, you'll see old racist uncles, you'll see a lot of everything.
And oddly enough, everybody's terrified of it.
Yeah.
Like people talk about it like it's Compton. And like,
they do, yeah.
Not.
There was a time.
Well, to be honest, where you live in Tacoma used to be like Compton.
I'm aware.
Yeah.
But that was 30 years ago. It's a little different now.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm being priced out. If it weren't for my landlord, I would have been priced out of that neighborhood 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Hilltop used to have a rep.
Yeah.
And It used to be basically like, hey, you want to see what it's like to live in a John Singleton amusement park? then, yeah, it would have been kind of like that. I think they have cleaned it up quite a bit. And the thing I find kind of fascinating about Hilltop, and it's sad to hear that people are getting priced out, but demographically, it hasn't been like, let's throw all the poor people out. I don't know what they did, but...
For the 10 years that I lived there, there was an increasing... the money in the neighborhood was rising, and the wellness of the people in that neighborhood was rising, and the demographics weren't changing.
The people were staying there,
but life was just getting better for them. The place wasn't gentrifying, it was just improving.
Yeah.
In the last 2 or 3 years, with Seattle becoming absolutely insane and a lot of people moving to the South Sound, it's totally gentrifying now.
That sucks.
It's a real, like, there's a high rise condominium complex that's probably going to block off my view of Commencement Bay. Yeah. But
that shittiness aside, how did Hilltop do that? Because normally, if we're going to clean up this town, usually means let's throw out poor people and people of color, but they managed to not do that.
Well, yeah, because Tacoma, I think they were really reticent to do that because they had done it several times in the past. Tacoma was actually kind of famous for that. I don't know. Like, I ask people who were there about it. Like, one of the people I work with at the radio station, he was a part of it. And his answer is always kind of vague. Like, I get there was just an interest in keeping the community. And then some of the fighting just sort of burned itself out. And people built with what was left. That's the sort of what, like, ultimately, I think that's kind of what happened. It's kind of, because, like, when I moved here now about 10 years ago, and I started hanging out up in Seattle and meeting people in Seattle, and I didn't realize Tacoma had the reputation it did. Because I came up to Seattle, I'm like, this is not really my thing. Tacoma's more my thing. I'm going to live in Tacoma. I said, well, yeah, you know, Tacoma's horrible. It smells and whatever. And I'm like, do you guys know your town smells like piss? Are you aware that your whole town smells like piss? Just, you know. And then that didn't go over well. And they say, well, you live in Tacoma. And I'm like, yeah, and it kind of stinks there. It's kind of a rough neighborhood. I'm like, it isn't really. And they go, yeah, you know, I guess there are nice parts of Tacoma. At least you don't live in Hilltop. And I go,
oh, say.
I have to go.
Yeah. But Hilltop,
I guess you could just put that down to the fact that people just don't visit it. And so they don't know. They've got a meme.
Well,
and they carry it forward.
What's happening now is we're having a little bit of cultural colonization. Which is annoying me a little bit, is that here I am trying to put a radio station together. We have an art scene. We have an ongoing things and projects going on in Tacoma. And I keep hitting things. So we have these ongoing projects and things like that. And then people come in from Seattle. And I was like, well, I was involved with these things in Seattle, and I'm here to bring culture to Tacoma. And I'm like, no, thanks.
Are you wearing a pith helmet?
Yeah.
It is. It's sort
like,
of.
It's bad enough that one of the radio stations I work for is called Radio Tacoma, and then there's this guy who's like, well, I work for KAXP, and I want to do music, I want to do these things, and Tacoma doesn't have any radio or anything like that, so I'm going to come down to Tacoma and start an online radio station, call it Radio Tacoma, and we're like,
about that.
Hey, do you want to work with us? We'll give you like days of airtime if you'd like. I'm good.
Yeah, that's because, again, you don't trust the savages to make it on their own,
right?
You know, I have to come down here and give you culture.
Yeah,
it's again.
Yes, and I too, being a Seattleite, think of you as being hairy, unwashed natives, barbarians.
Well, it doesn't help that you go to my house while I'm recording Ask an Atheist, and I'm literally those things.
I will say there are...
This is not true. That was totally sarcastic.
But Seattle has its stereotypes, too. I mean, yeah. I live in Kent, which is not well thought of. I mean, Almost Live, our local sketch comedy show from the 80s, basically made us like the monster truck tractor pull sort of jokes about people in Kent.
Which is odd, because all those tractor pulls and monster truck rallies happen in Tacoma.
They do. But... I generally, my worst stereotypes of Seattle are essentially you're the bad guys from Caddyshack. It's
surely they do exist. Yeah, surely they do.
There is a certain kind of snobbishness of the kind of effete liberal snobs that are there. I mean, and who dislike things in principle but have never actually seen one in the wild.
There's, yeah, like I often bag on Seattle because whatever, that's the culture here. But there is a lot to. There's a lot to say for Seattle as a town.
Oh, there's a lot of great things in Seattle.
I think the perspective to take is just there's a lot to the what is greater Western Washington, and surely there's a lot of bad that is happening in Seattle in terms of culture and in terms of gentrification and whatnot. But Western Washington is a very large place, and there's lots of amazing people and things.
Well, what's happening to Seattle now is that Seattle took a job where the boss requires that they go to the range every weekend. That's what's happening to Seattle right now. So I identify.
And Seattle's got a terrible aim.
Yeah.
I think we can all come together and and put aside our differences and so I'll say, at least we're not Bellevue. Those guys actually are the bad guys from Caddyshack.
So have I mentioned the fact that I want to do a movie night on your show yet? Have I done that?
No.
Okay.
Mike, let's just talk about this. About that.
So I've done something.
This probably isn't going to get on the podcast, I'm guessing.
I was actually.
Hey, let's go for it.
It was maybe you can use it or not.
Okay.
But I've done something weird in that I've started having New Year's resolutions and committing to them. The joke is people make New Year's resolutions and never commit to them. And so I never did them because I'm an irritable asshole. But last year I made a resolution that I would start being very aware of my time and telling people no, like that one episode of Mork and Mindy.
This is important.
Yeah, where he actually plays Robin Williams. And I think I've succeeded this year. I think I did pretty well.
You have a lot of people asking for your time, obviously.
They're going to reach up and say, Sam, save us. And you'll look down and whisper, no.
And then I'll try to hide the front of my pants. I just did that. Anyway, and I decided that part of what I want to do in 2019 is reacquaint myself with media. Because I got overwhelmed, and I stopped watching movies. And I don't like that I stopped watching movies. I don't have a problem. Like, I didn't start hating media. I just started being too busy. And I was proud of being too busy. And I'm like, nah, that's crap. Let's not do that. So I want to start watching. I want to have a movie night.
Yeah.
Is it going to have to exist within the rubric, the heuristic of Sam movies, which is no sequels and no superhero movies?
No. Okay. Because the very first movie I've selected is Thor Ragnarok.
I'm intensely
curious about the movie because it's got Jeff Goldblum being Jeff Goldblum in it, which I always like. And it's got a score by Mike Mothersbaugh from Devo. Mm-hmm. And, like, okay, if you were trying to genetically design a movie that I would watch, you did a fairly good job, Thor Ragnarok. And so I want to start with that. And
it's also Taika Waititi, which is, he's a hilarious director.
Oh, really?
He's the guy who did What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah.
Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, like everything I hear about this movie sounds pretty great. Yeah.
It's very Kiwi in places.
Yeah. And so I want to pick it, but I want to, like, I want to pick the movies, but I want, like I'm not just going to say every movie made since 2014, because no.
When you're coming out of your cave.
Yeah. And so if anybody has any suggestions of things that I really, really should see for cultural literacy purposes...
I can help with that.
I also have one. And I also thought maybe your Patreon friends might be able to help me out with that.
Yes.
It's a little bit like Phil Rich's Hole, but I'm not a... This wasn't forced upon me. This was a self-imposed exile.
There's a combination of words out of context that are fun. And I have decided to not explain them.
Awesome. Just Google it, please.
Yeah.
Please Google that phrase.
It's www.hotmail.com. MALE hotmail.com.
Oh,
that's where you'll end up.
Oh, I'm afraid that one probably exists.
Oh,
surely it exists.
I'm not afraid. I know. Yeah, it totally exists.
I would recommend doing that on a computer you're not afraid to lose.
Fire up Tor.
Radio versus the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Val Verde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music was written and performed by Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobias Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Dan Lombardo. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
So, what culinary delights will tickle the pickle tonight?
Potato tots and chocolate.
Right, okay, no problem.
The payment's due, Chen.
Please, I can't keep doing this.
Now.
Bad guy, right?
Yep.
You come in here again. In fact, you go anywhere in the city preying on innocent people, and we will find you and eat both your arms and then both of your legs, and then we will eat your face right off your head. Do you understand?
Please.
Yes. So you will be this armless, legless, faceless thing, won't you? Rolling down the street like a turd in the wind. Do you feel me?
What the hell are you?
We are Venom.